And now, your hosts for Life from the Pulpits, here's Nick Perez.
That's right. You can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it. The fastest half-hour podcast in the West. This is Live from the Pulpit, coming to you live and local from deep in the heart of the San Joaquin Valley, deep in the heart of Davis Park Church of Christ in Modesto, California. I am your guide on this excursion into theology and sundry matters. The voice of the valley, Nick Perez, offering up news and views you can use on Scripture and society with a little help from my friends. Greetings. Welcome to the program. Glad you tuned in. Sponsor this half hour, Davis Park Church of Christ, located at 901 West Rumble Road, Davis Park Church of Christ in Modesto, California, is composed of people who have received the mercy of God, who are focused upon the mission of God, and who engage in ministry for God. Davis Park Church of Christ meets every Lord's Day, that's Sunday, for Bible study at 9:30 a.m., morning worship at 10:45 a.m., and also midweek Bible study every Wednesday at 7 p.m. She's served by her preaching minister, yours truly, as well as her outreach minister, Buddy Gray. Go online and visit davisparkchurchmodesto.com for more information. Davis Park Church of Christ, making a difference, one person at a time. As we continue to look at the miracles of Jesus, we look now at one of the miracles that was performed for an outsider, for someone who was outside of Israel and the people of God. From everything we gather in Scripture, Jesus was an emotional man. When his good friend Lazarus died, he wept. When people turned the temple into a den of robbers, he got angry. And when a Gentile centurion makes a statement of faith, such as we have in Luke 7 and verse 8, and that done through a messenger also, Jesus, his jaw drops. Or at least that's how I'm interpreting the word amazed, or he marveled at him. Someone has called this centurion the morning star of Western faith. And I think that's accurate. You see, Jesus, he has just finished the Sermon on the Plain. Not the Sermon on the Mount. This is a different incident. That was a different sermon. He comes to the next town, probably eager to help someone. That was Jesus' MO. They've already heard about Jesus, everything he's been doing, and this Roman centurion, who has a sick servant in his house, has heard of Jesus, has heard of the great things that Jesus has been able to do. He's apparently heard that Jesus is able to make sick people well, and so he sends for him. But as you put the whole composite picture together of Matthew 8, verses 5 through 13, Luke 7, 1 through 10, you have a very interesting account here. First of all, let's talk about centurions. What is a centurion? Just in case we need to get caught up on this, no doubt he was a Gentile. That means he was not an Israelite. He was outside of the people of God, not part of the covenant people of God. But this is a military man. He would have been in command of about 100 guys who would be under his command. He was a leader of the imperial occupying force. And so the Jewish people, they would have viewed him as doubly unclean. First, for his race, the Gentile, not part of the people of God. And second, because he represented that Roman subjugation, that imperial occupying force. And yet, this man, as we're told here by the elders of the Jews, this man, he has a love for the nation of Israel. He respects and perhaps even engages in the religion, and even built the synagogue for the Jews. So this was a devout man, a man who appreciated Judaism. He's heard about Jesus' ability to heal, and so he sends a couple of delegations to Jesus, imploring Jesus, begging Jesus, on behalf of a beloved servant. So that also reveals part of this man's character. You see, under that tough soldier exterior, there was apparently a kind and generous and gracious heart. And when he finally sends the right delegation, we'll talk about the wrong delegation here in a moment, but when he finally sends the right delegation with his message in their mouth, and even if you want to say that, yes, he is the one who showed up, although there's a way to harmonize these passages concerning representation and how the ancient world understood that. When that right delegation finally shows up, he acknowledges the lordship of Jesus, calls him Lord. That is noticeably absent from the Jewish delegation. And that's the first group that shows up, the elders of the people. Luke records this in Luke 7, verses 3 through 5. The centurion heard about Jesus. He sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He's worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he is the one who built us our synagogue." They have nothing but good to say about this Gentile. That's incredible, considering what the Jewish people thought about Gentiles. They thought that they were created just to stoke the fires of hell. That's why God made Gentiles. And yet, because of all the good things he's done, Jesus, haven't you seen the wonderful synagogue he's built? You know, I know he's a Gentile. I know he's going to spend eternity stoking the fires of hell. But surely this man, he's done some good things for the Jewish people. He deserves, or he is worthy of the healing you can give, Jesus. Make no mistake about this. None of us deserves any good thing from God. The only thing we deserve from God is the fiery pit of hell. That's the arrogance of these elders of the Jews. They make this demand from the great physician for healing. And by the way, let me just throw this out here. Do you think that the elders of the Jews here are really sincerely concerned about this centurion or his servant? Typically, the role that the leadership in the Jewish nation, the role that they play is typically adversarial when it comes to Jesus. They are not his friends. And usually what we see them trying to do is trying to catch Jesus in his words or catch him in some kind of act where they can get him on a point in the law. And that seems, to me at least, what they're doing. Could this be a trap that the elders of the Jews are setting? There's no acknowledgement of the lordship of Jesus. Now they know that in the law, at least by implication, it's unlawful for a Jew to associate with or visit a Gentile. Peter says this in Acts 10 and verse 28. You can look up Leviticus chapter 18, verse 24, Deuteronomy 7, verse 3, which are passages that communicate how the Jewish people aren't supposed to intermingle or intermarry with the Gentile people around them. Also, and you can look up Matthew chapter 15, verses 21 through 28, where Jesus has an interaction with a Gentile woman, and how that conversation, at least to our Western ears, seems kind of callous, almost cruel, and yet there's a purpose behind it, because Jesus multiple times says he's come for the lost sheep of Israel. Therefore, when it comes to what's going on here with the elders of the people pleading with him earnestly, go help this centurion. We've seen before where the elders of the people, the elders of the Jews, they approach Jesus and they have very questionable motives. In fact, they usually have ulterior motives to catch him in his words. I think this is a trap. If they can just get him in that Gentile's house, aha, you associate with a Gentile. Why don't you keep the law, right? That's what they're going to do. Well, then why in the world, Luke 7, verse 6, does Jesus go with them, right? I believe Jesus went with them fully expecting a teachable moment, knowing that the centurion, Jesus knows people's hearts, and distance ain't a thing for Jesus. That's what this miracle is going to show us, by the way. Time and space doesn't matter to Jesus. He can heal anywhere, and I think the same thing is true for knowing people's hearts. I think he knew that the centurion would come to him and humbly turn him away because he isn't worthy. And leave off what the Jews, the elders of the Jews say. I'm not worthy, he'll say. And that is going to set this whole thing up for what we read in Matthew 8, verses 10, 11, and 12. Where Jesus gives a judgment saying and also a faith pronouncement, but the judgment is here very heavy. And that seems to be the main emphasis of this whole narrative. The miracle is almost secondary to that. It's there. It's there. But this whole thing is driving toward that judgment saying in Matthew's gospel. So, as we continue, Luke 7, verse 6, he's not far from the house. The centurion sent friends, saying to him, Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof. Right? You go over to Matthew's account, Matthew 8 and verse 5. He enters Capernaum. The centurion came forward to him. And again, I think this is representative language. Okay? Through this second delegation, these friends, these messengers, he sends this message. Lord, my servant is lying paralyzed at home, suffering terribly. And that's when we read in verse 7. Most English translations have what Jesus says here as a statement. I will come and heal him. But again, that seems inconsistent with what we read later in Matthew 15, 21 through 28, where he has that encounter with a Gentile woman. And just based on the research that I've done, there is one English translation, the New International Version, okay, the latest edition of that, NIV. It's the only translation to render it a question. Shall I come and heal him? Why a question, and why does it seem best to translate it that way? Well, no doubt, given this centurion's affinity for the Jewish religion, he knows the ordinary customs of the Jews. That is, Jews and Gentiles don't associate. He knows that. And so Jesus, see, even the elders of the Jews, they were like, yeah, you got to do it, you got to do it, right? But as Jesus interacts with this centurion, he seems to have a better handle on how this should all go down. Shall I come and heal him? And that's when the centurion replied, Lord, and you get the double lordship here. Verse 6, also verse 8, Lord, I'm not worthy to have you come under my roof, but only say the word and my servant will be healed. For I too, verse 9, am a man under authority with soldiers under me. And I say to one, go, and he goes, to another, come, and he comes, and to my servant, do this, and he does it. This is the statement that causes Jesus' jaw to drop. He brings a very different message to Jesus. Instead of saying, I'm a man of authority and I demand you to do this. I should have special privileges. And I deserve it because of what I've been doing for Judaism. He says the complete opposite. I don't deserve this. I don't deserve any of this. And here's his faith response. You ready? Jesus, just say the word. There is nothing in the Gospels so far, chronologically, in the life of Jesus, the life and ministry of Jesus, that prepares us for this centurion to just assume that Jesus can do this distance healing. Typically, what we've seen is people bringing their sick to Jesus. You know, he usually goes to a place for the evening, so he's going to stay there overnight. And people find out, they bring the sick to Jesus, Matthew 4:24 or Luke 4:40. Or, as he's traveling on the way, he runs into people, like the leper that we saw in the previous episode. So, just experientially, there is nothing that would hint, there's no way that this centurion should expect Jesus to be able to do this since he hasn't done it this way before. Oh man, boy, if there isn't a message there for us, we've never seen it done this way. We've never done it that way before. Yeah, and yet this centurion has enough faith to reason from his position of authority. It's almost Abrahamic, isn't it? Where he believed that if Isaac was dead, God could bring him back from the dead. And figuratively, he did receive him back from the dead. This is Hebrews 11 stuff. He reasons from his position of authority. That's a key word, by the way, in all the miracles. Jesus' authority over sickness or death or what have you. He reasons, well, you know, when I say something, soldiers, they go, or they come, or they do stuff. They're under his command. Sickness is under the command of Jesus. And if he just says the word, sickness will flee, disease is gone, and the rest. And so he becomes the morning star of Western faith. It's appropriate that Jesus heals this servant from afar off because he's ministering to Gentiles who are those who are far off. But he's preaching peace to them, isn't he? Ephesians 2:17. And we, many centuries later, we must follow this example of this Gentile and accept our position before the Lord. We're at peace with Christ. We're at peace with God. We can ask with boldness for anything we need. But ever present in our mind should be the fact that we're asking this of the all-powerful cosmic sovereign Lord. He's so much greater and mightier and holier than we are. We can't lose sight of that. And we must make our pleas and our petitions with all humility. This whole miracle closes with this judgment saying, which deals with a pilgrimage and a banquet. Jesus says to those who follow, to the crowd, there's a crowd following him, "Truly I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith," jaw-dropping faith, okay? Verses 11 and 12 of Matthew 8. It's also in Luke 13. Luke puts it in a different place, and there's a different emphasis there, but regardless, here's the judgment saying, "I tell you, many will come from east and west and recline at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, while the sons of the kingdom will be thrown into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." Pilgrimage and banquet. The many who will come from east and west, those are Gentiles. They're going to make the pilgrimage. Same kind of pilgrimage that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob made. You see the connection there. They were wanderers. They were pilgrims. Banquet, see Isaiah 25 and verse 6 for more on the banquet that has rich foods and all that that's prepared in the kingdom. And so Jesus, he uses those familiar Old Testament motifs in order to issue a judgment saying against Israel. Who are the sons of the kingdom? There in verse 12, it's Israel. It's the people of God, the nation. And so Jesus envisions the many from east and west, many Gentiles coming and reclining at table with the pilgrim fathers of the faith. That's always been God's desire, by the way. See Isaiah 60, verses 1 through 4, about how Israel was supposed to be a light in shining in darkness for the Gentiles. It's always been God's desire for the nations to come. And so this saying would have been scandalous to the crowd around Jesus, since they're the original audience would have been the sons of the kingdom, would have been Israelites. And they're going to be thrown into this place of outer darkness, utter outer darkness, weeping, gnashing of teeth. That's sounds like hell to me, right? Yeah, so this is judgment language. And it's intended to be a statement for the people then to hear and to respond. You don't want to be left out of this banquet. Make the pilgrimage yourself. Go and let it be done for you as you have believed, Jesus says in verse 13. The servant was healed at that very moment. There's your miracle. All right, today in church history, Pope Innocent I excommunicates Pelagius in the year 417. 417, by the way, who was Pelagius? This isn't Darth Pelagius, okay, from episode, which one was it? Was it 3? Anyway, Star Wars. No, that's not what this is. Pelagius and Pelagians were people that Augustine, that great scholar from the 4th, 5th century, Augustine opposed Pelagius. He was a monk from Britain. He'd become famous for his piety and austerity. And he saw the Christian life as this constant struggle through which one's sins could be overcome and salvation could be attained. He agreed with Augustine that God makes us free and that the source of evil is in the will. But as he saw matters, this meant that human beings always have the ability to overcome their sin. Otherwise, if they couldn't, sin would be excusable. How could God hold us accountable for something we can't not do, right? Well, according to Augustine, the power of sin is such that it takes hold of our will, and as long as we are under its sway, we can't move our will to be rid of it. So, how can we then make the decision to accept grace? Well, according to Augustine, only by the power of grace itself. For before that moment, we are not free not to sin, and therefore we're not free to decide to accept grace. In other words, grace is irresistible. That's where Augustine ended up. Pelagius, on the other hand, claimed that each of us comes to the world with complete freedom to sin or not to sin, and that there's no such thing as original sin nor a corruption of the human nature that forces us to sin. Children have no sin until they, on their own free will, decide to sin. That's the argument. That was the debate that they were having at the time. Pelagius came down on one side, free will. Augustine came down on the other side with irresistible grace. And what ended up happening, Augustine's view ended up winning the day. And so Pope Innocent excommunicated Pelagius. And this is what they said. They wrote, "We judge by the authority of apostolic power that Pelagius and Celestius," that's another one of his cohorts, "they be deprived of ecclesiastical communion until they return to the faith out of the snares of the devil." What do you do when you disagree with people in matters of faith? How do we disagree with each other and yet maintain unity? Is it possible? Well, Pelagius and Augustine and their doctrines could not reach a middle ground. And so on this day, 1,600 years ago, Pelagius was excommunicated from the church.
And now it's time for the question of the day. Question of the day. This is the question of the day on Life from the Pulpit.
Does God afflict people with the wounds of Christ, as in the movie Stigmata? I think I'm going to do two today, two questions. And this is the first. And let me just start by saying, in the first place, why are you watching Stigmata? It's a terrible movie. Oh, it's awful. The acting, the whole plot, it's just, anyway. Why are you watching? So, about Stigmata. Does God afflict people with the wounds of Christ? There are a lot of people who think so. The Catholic Church says it's a miracle. And that's how you can attain sainthood, one way at least, by demonstrating this miracle of Stigmata. I'm not so convinced about that. Why? What's the point, right? Why would God do that? There's enough suffering in the world. Why would he cause more of it? It would seem that this is more in line with a counterfeit miracle that the evil one would perform. And we know that he does that, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2. So, yeah, I'm not inclined to see Stigmata as something that God does, as a miracle that he performs on people. Just it doesn't make sense. And, don't watch Stigmata. I lament that I've even seen it. It was on Sci-Fi Channel. Anyway, since that one was so quick, let's go to a second one. Is it okay to pray in silence? And when should you pray out loud? Well, in terms of praying, you can pray in silence. God knows the heart. We were talking about that earlier, right? God, Christ, he knows what's in a man. John, the end of John chapter 2. We don't have to vocalize every prayer that we say. In fact, there's examples of those who were praying in their hearts. Hannah is one in 1 Samuel chapter 1. Where she is praying in her heart, praying in her mind, and she's kind of mouthing the words with her lips. And her husband sees that, thinks she's drunk, and she's like, no, I'm just praying to myself. Nehemiah is another example. In Nehemiah chapter 1, where he offers up we call it a flare prayer, right? It's right before he is going to make a request of the king to go back to the land, the promised land, so that he can help rebuild the walls around Jerusalem and stuff like that. And so he offers up a real quick prayer just in his heart, doesn't say it out loud. When should you pray out loud? Well, Jesus talks about going into your closet and praying. I think that's a good place. I don't think we should do it on street corners in order to garner and gain some kind of attention. I don't think that's right. But certainly in private, we can pray out loud. We pray. There are those who lead us in prayer on Sunday mornings. They pray aloud. And so those are appropriate times when we're leading others in prayer. We have to open our mouths and speak out loud. So there are appropriate times for that. And certainly we can do it in private. But we can, even in private, we can pray silently in our hearts, in our minds, to God as well, and he hears those prayers. Okay, so yeah, it is okay to pray in silence, and God hears those prayers. All right, I'm out of time. Feel free to leave a comment on the website. I always like to hear what you have to say. Search Facebook, Life from the Pulpit, like the Facebook page, and you'll get updates when I go live with a podcast, update the blog, or post a new video on YouTube. Speaking of YouTube, search YouTube, Life from the Pulpit, and the YouTube channel is there, with plenty of question of the day segments for you to use and peruse in your everyday Bible study. Follow me on Twitter, @InPulpit, at the letter N as a Nick Pulpit, P-U-L-P-I-T. Same handle on Instagram. Now on iTunes, search the iTunes store, download all the episodes to your particular device, and you'll never be more than a click away from an episode of the podcast. Be sure and stop at the Life from the Pulpit blog, L-I-F-E, from the pulpit.wordpress.com. All of my commentary there on Luke, James, 1st, 2nd, 3rd, John, Philippians, Ephesians. Now there's some stuff from the Psalms on there as well. Check out Davis Park Church of Christ website, DavisParkChurchModesto.com, DavisParkChurchModesto.com. Plenty of sermon audio there as well to help you in your daily walk with the Lord. And as always, brethren, grace be with you all. Thanks for listening.